I get asked the same question nearly every time I get back home from a meeting. People will say, was it a good meeting? And I used to respond to that a lot of different ways. I guess it depended on what kind of meeting it was. I could respond to it like one preacher in Texas. Every time he went back, he classified all his meetings in the same way. They'd say, what kind of meeting was it? He'd say it was a 7-pounder, depending on how much he ate that particular weekend. I'm not sure yet what this one equates to by way of weight, but I've had a bounty of food, as is always the case, and grateful for that. But I now think in terms of a statement that was made by Joe Paterno in an interview I saw with him, and I'm not necessarily a big Penn State fan, but I loved this one particular comment that Joe Paterno, who, if you're not familiar with who he is the coach of the Penn State football team and has been for eons, it seems like, was asked on one occasion. He had had several national championship teams and a lot of good teams, and the interviewer said, what's the best team you've ever coached? He paused for a moment, and he said, I can't answer that. He says, if you can tell me where all the boys I coached were 10 years after they left my program, I'll tell you who's the best team I ever coached. I thought, wow, what a great statement. Because it isn't what they did on the field. It wasn't the immediate that determined that. What did they do with their lives? What lessons did they learn, and what application did they make of that once they had been in his system, is what he was asking. And if you'll tell me where they are and what they've done with the information I gave them, then I'll know. And so I tell people now, they say, was it a good meeting? I say, can't begin to tell you that. I said, let's check back with them in a few years and see where they are. That'll determine whether it's a good meeting, like any sermon. Is a good sermon a sermon that was delivered well? Not really. A good sermon's a sermon that changed people's lives because they listened to what God had to say and they made changes. And that's the determination. Where will our marriages be a year from now, 5 years from now? That'll determine what we accomplished, at least, in this meeting. What will I do with my marriage? Will I continue to grow? Will you continue to grow? And that'll make that determination. We're talking this morning about making a covenant marriage, and I don't know that there's anything that I could possibly teach on marriage that would be any more important than this particular subject. I want you to just think in terms of a covenant first, and the very nature of a covenant. If you'll open up to Genesis chapter 15. In Genesis chapter 15, we have a covenant being made between God and Abram. And we see some things about the nature of a covenant. And we're going to read that passage in just a moment. But before we do, I want to just portray for you something. Because as the covenant is done here in Genesis chapter 15, in a very similar fashion, in some ancient wedding ceremonies that would have been associated with those kinds of culture, there were covenant ceremonies of marriage. Not all, but some were done as a covenant ceremony of marriage. And so here's what basically would happen. Not suggesting this is something we would want to duplicate, but this is what would happen. They would take animals and cut them in half, the same as they're going to do in Genesis chapter 15. So they were going to take an animal and cut it in half from head all the way down through the tail section of that animal and just split it in half and lay the halves side by side. And they would do that with whatever animals they were going to do that with, cows and sheep, and lay those animals side to side. And the couple that was going to get married would remove their shoes, their sandals, whatever, and they would walk between those animals as they were making that covenant. That was the nature of a covenant agreement. And they walked through there. You can imagine, that's a pretty gruesome sight. I mean, you cut animals in half. There's a great deal of carnage there, and there's a lot of blood that is on the ground. They would walk between those animals, and in doing so, would be walking barefoot through the blood and would be staining their feet with that blood. I'm not suggesting that's a good idea. I'm grateful that my ceremony looked nothing like that, I can tell you. But I would ask you this, because as they got on the other side, here was the significance of that. The significance was, as they looked at their feet and saw the blood of those animals, the significance was, if I do not keep the agreement that I am making today, may I pay with my own blood for not keeping it. That was the significance of the blood in a blood covenant. May I pay with my own blood if I do not keep the covenant that I'm presently making. But I would ask you this, whether you like that idea or not, whether you would have ever wanted to see that or not, there is no question in my mind, if you had done that, if that is what your ceremony had been, would it even be possible, do you think, to forget that image at some point? I mean, that would be stuck and emblazoned in our minds so strongly, it just seems to me you'd never be able to forget that. That's exactly what the intent was. That's the nature of covenant. There is just some things associated with covenant, and as we look at a covenant today, I want us to look at four similarities of marriage ceremony to covenants and why we need to view them, so that the one goal of this whole lesson is that when we leave this building today, that if we are married or if we shall someday become married, that we either view now our marriage as a covenant, or if we sometime later become married, we will view our marriage as a covenant. And that should mean something to us, and it should be of great significance to us. In Genesis chapter 15, starting in verse 9, talking about the Lord, "So he said to him, bring me a three-year-old heifer, a three-year-old female goat, a three-year-old ram, a turtle dove, and a young pigeon. And then he brought all these to him and cut them in two down the middle and placed each piece opposite the other. But he did not cut the birds in two. And when the vultures came down on the carcasses, Abram drove them away. Now when the sun was going down, a deep sleep fell upon Abram, and behold, horror and great darkness fell upon him. And he said to Abram, know certainly that your descendants will be strangers in a land that is not theirs, and will serve them, and they will afflict them 400 years. And also the nation whom they serve I will judge afterward. They shall come out with great possessions. Now as for you, you shall go to your fathers in peace, and you shall be buried at a good old age. But in the fourth generation they shall return here, for the iniquity of the Amorites is not yet complete. And it came to pass that when the sun went down and it was dark, that behold, there appeared a smoking oven and a burning torch that passed between those pieces. And on the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abram, saying, to your descendants I have given this land." God made a covenant with Abram on this day. Later, Abram will enter into a covenant with God as well. But right now, God is making a covenant with Abram. It is the nature of what is being said. And so God is saying certain things to Abram, and he wants him to understand the nature of what that means, that I'm saying these things in covenant form. Four things that we want to look at. Who all was at? Do you remember? Some people had large weddings. Some had smaller weddings. We had, I'm guessing there were 250 people, something like that, at our wedding. Of which that was one of those weddings, you know, when they divide them up, friends of the groom, friends of the bride, that they couldn't do that because it just looks odd if there's eight people on my side and 242 on Judy's. So they kind of split them up a little differently than that. But she was, and her family, very well known in that area, and so we had a rather, I thought, large wedding. I couldn't begin to tell you. I might be able to list for you some people who were there because they've remained close throughout the years, but I couldn't tell you who all was there, but I can tell you a couple of people that were there because they meant something very special to me. And I thought, who do you remember from your wedding? Who was the most important person to you at your wedding? I read a thing and saw something on TV a few years back where Oprah and her friend went and visited. I don't even remember her friend's name, but they went and visited several weddings. Do you remember seeing that? They went not only in presence CE, but in presence TS as well. And so I think that's why they were accepted at those weddings. They went with large loads of gifts to weddings they weren't invited to. But just imagine that you're one of those people, and imagine if she means something to you, that you could tell, you know what, Oprah was at my wedding. Or can you imagine, who at your wedding? Can you imagine if you could have had one person that was more famous or more popular to you, whether it was a sports figure, a political figure, some other kind of historical figure, whether it was somebody that was known for some other great thing. And being able to tell people, you know what, you know who was at my wedding? This person was at my wedding. Well, who was there? Because that's the first similarity between the nature of covenant being made and a ceremony. And that is that marriage and covenants are both vows that are taken before God. God was at your wedding. Think about that. I mean, we lose sight of that sometimes. Even, I would tell you, that's sometimes what we wrestle with when we think about reverence in a worship period. Sometimes if we really grasp the fact that Jesus didn't say, you know what, I'm looking down watching what you're doing. He said, when two or three are gathered in my name, there I am. If we could get the picture that when I'm here, the building, we understand, doesn't mean anything. The building is insignificant. It is a building. It's got a purpose. The building's insignificant. But what we do here, when we gather like this. That's greatly significant. And Jesus says, if you'd understood, I'm sitting beside you, in effect. I'm there with you. Well, that would help me stay very reverent, I think, in our worship, no question. If I saw the Lord sitting next to me, I think my reverence wouldn't have any difficulty. I'd pay attention, those kinds of things. God says, you understand at your wedding, it wasn't just all those people that were sitting out there. God says, I was there. Every time I perform a wedding ceremony, one of the ways we start that is always what? We're gathered here in the presence of God. We tell people that we're making these vows in the presence of God. How important is that? Look at Deuteronomy chapter 23. In Deuteronomy chapter 23, God talks a little about the concept of vows and covenant. Verse 21 says, when you make a vow to the Lord your God, you shall not delay to pay it. For the Lord your God will surely require it of you, and it would be a sin to you. But if you abstain from vowing, it shall not be a sin. That which has gone out from your lips, you shall keep and perform, for you voluntarily vowed to the Lord your God what you have promised with your mouth. God says, here's what is the case, Mark, with your wedding. Nobody made you do that. You chose to do that. And so as you were acknowledging certain things and saying to God certain things, he says, understand, I didn't force you to say that, but you can trust this, that I will expect you to keep it because you voluntarily made those vows. That's the nature of a covenant. We are making sure that we understand that we're going to keep the things that we promised. God heard every single vow that I made. And he wants me to understand that. This isn't just an agreement between you and Judy, he's saying. This isn't some kind of contract that you signed. This is a covenant whereby you have agreed something. It's based on honesty. The very nature of a contract is based on mistrust. That's why a wedding's not a contract, it's a covenant. It's not based on mistrust, it's based on trust. Why do you sign a contract? It didn't always used to be that way. When everybody really trusted their neighbor, people would do what? Somebody would say, hey, I'll paint your house for such and such dollars. The other guy would say, hey, that works for me. They'd shake hands and everything went perfectly, didn't it? How many of the people in the world are you willing to just say, you know what, I'll just shake your hand, I'll just trust, here's the money. Shake your hand and come do it. We don't do that with most people. We sign contracts because there's mistrust on both sides. We want to be able to hold somebody liable to what they've agreed. God says, covenant's not that way. Covenant is based on trust. You have promised, therefore you shall do. Or in this case, in Genesis 15, God has promised, therefore he will do. It's important to recognize, first off, that our vows are taken before God, and he takes that very seriously. Secondly, marriage and covenants are both before witnesses. In Matthew chapter 18, not a passage on marriage at all, but Jesus said, you know what, and there's kind of a little side sermon here that we could go into if we wanted to, that brethren everywhere typically are in need of. Jesus said, you got a problem with somebody? Who do you go to? Go talk to the person you've got the problem with. Well, we wrestle with that concept sometimes, don't we? We talk about the problem we've got, or we talk to other people regarding the problem, but we don't always talk to the person. Jesus says, go talk to him. He says, you know what? You might not be able to solve it that way. What if the two of you can't solve it? Hopefully you can. That's what he wants you to do. But if you can't solve it, he says, take more people back with you. For what purpose? Witnesses establish the factual nature of what is being said and done. That's the purpose of a witness, is it not? Why is it that you don't receive an accusation against an elder, one who's an overseer, without two or three witnesses? You need to establish the factual nature of something if you're going to receive that. That's the nature of witnesses. It's interesting. How many people had a guest book at your wedding? Can you remember your guest book? We don't use those the way they were originally intended to be used. You know, now people come in and they sign the guest book as they come in, don't they? And they do that for a multitude of reasons. We want to send thank you cards for coming to the wedding, and we let them know that. And the guest book is for our purposes that way. Or maybe they gave us some kind of present. We want to let them know that we received that, and we send them that. But they sign it as they come in. That isn't the way it started. It started that they signed the guest book as they went out. For what purpose? They were witnesses to what had gone on. That's what they were signing. The same as I have to have people sign as witnesses when I do a wedding. That was the nature. They were witnesses of the wedding. When I got married, or we got married, at our reception. I had not been a Christian very long. And I found out later, I had some inklings then, but I found out later that there are some people in Judy's circles that didn't think she had made the best choice she could have made for marriage. I'd come out of a background considerably different than hers, one of which spiritual interest was never a part of my background for just a long time until just not too long before we had gotten married. So I was a new Christian, but I was trying to break some habits that I had as a non-Christian. And I was at our wedding reception, and Brother Melvin Curry, who I just have the greatest respect for, Brother Curry came up and tapped me on the shoulder. I was talking to somebody. I can't even remember who I was talking to. It just shocked me when he hit me, or just tapped me on the shoulder. And I turned around, and he said, and pointed at me. He said, "Did you hear what you said?" And I'm immediately the wheels are turning. I'm looking at the person. I'm thinking, you know what? I used to use pretty foul language. I wonder if he heard me cursing at my wedding reception. Surely I had more control than to say something foul at my own wedding reception. I'm playing all of that through my mind, and I'm thinking, I just don't recall. And I said, "Brother Curry, I don't understand." And he did exactly the same thing. He says, "Did you hear what you said?" And I thought, man, you know what? Maybe I was talking about somebody. I know Christians aren't supposed to gossip, and we didn't concern ourselves too much with that before I was a Christian. We just said what we thought. And I thought, you know what, I bet I was talking about somebody and I was out of line. I didn't mean to be talking about somebody. But I kept playing the conversation through my mind over and over again with this individual that I was talking to and just could not place anything that I'd said that was improper. I said, "Brother Kerr, I am sorry. I just don't understand. What did I say?" He said, "I'm talking about when you were up front and the preacher was asking you to repeat vows after him. And he was making you make promises. Did you hear what you said?" "Because I did." That was 34 years ago, this past Thursday. I can remember that conversation like it happened yesterday. It is just always there. I can visualize. I mean, I'm considerably larger than Brother Curry. But I can tell you there was a great deal of fear listening to him ask me those questions. I can remember that vividly, but all he was saying was, "I watched this girl grow up. I know her family. I heard what you promised, and I'm going to hold you to it." That's what he said. Do you ever think of yourself at a wedding as being a witness who is taking responsibility to hold somebody accountable to the promises they've made? He understood that. I'd never, ever thought of going to a wedding in attendance and thinking part of my role of being there is to witness what they have said and help them to remain accountable to the promises that they had made. But that's exactly what he said. Our weddings are conducted before lots of witnesses, and as those witnesses, we need to be the type of people who help hold couples accountable to the promises they've made. That's how serious it is. I read a great article about weddings in Russia some time back, where I'm trying to think what he's called. I can think of the maid of honor, best man. I could not think what he was called. Where the best man has to sign an agreement that if the wedding doesn't last for a certain duration, he pays a fine. That might make you rethink being the best man, wouldn't it? I'm guaranteeing the wedding. All they're saying is, if you're the one closest to this couple, you're the one who needs to help hold them accountable to what they're doing. We conducted our wedding before witnesses, and there were lots of them at mine. And all God is wanting me to understand is they should be holding you accountable to that. We need to help others to be held accountable as well. Thirdly, marriage and covenants both declare the seriousness of the commitment. You didn't enter into a covenant with somebody to buy a hoe, you know, or a rake or a sickle or something from them. You didn't even enter into a covenant to buy a cow or a sheep or something from them. You would make agreements, but you didn't have covenants. They didn't cut animals in half for those kind of transactions. Covenants were made because two countries were making peace with one another, because marriages were going on, because some kind of lifetime agreement. The very fact that it was a covenant indicated how serious it was. In Ruth, it's the mindset, even though that's not a marriage arrangement, it's the mindset of that kind of commitment. You remember Ruth saying, wherever you go, I will go. That's how serious this is. Wherever you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people. Your God shall be my God. Those are statements of incredible seriousness. That's the nature of a covenant. Think about what you vowed when you got married, because yours probably wasn't greatly dissimilar to most of what we had. I vowed to love Judy for better or for worse, in sickness and in health, in prosperity or adversity. All those things were said specifically to me, all of which I agreed to, and I said, regardless of any of these things, I will love her. She vowed to love me the same way back in return, and vowed to be faithful to those promises as well in return. I hope she keeps up to that, but I would tell you, as we discussed in Ephesians chapter 5 earlier this weekend, it doesn't even make any difference if she does or doesn't. I vowed what I vowed, and God expects me to keep it. That's how serious that is. It isn't, as one man, I loved how one man responded. He was asked, do you take this woman for better or for worse, for richer or for poor, in sickness and in health? And he paused, you know, just a little bit longer than most would have been comfortable with, and he said, yes, no, yes, no, no, yes. It isn't six questions. It's one commitment regardless of circumstance. You just cannot approach covenant as if it is not as serious as it really is. I would tell you, here's how important this is. Our brethren have had lots of discussions over the years regarding the whole concept of marriage, divorce, and remarriage. And I'm not saying that's not valuable. I think it is. God has teachings on those things. And I think it's critically important that we adhere to the teachings of God on those things. But here's the part that disturbs me. Because I'm absolutely convinced that if we spent more time on the front end of this equation, more time on helping people understand what marriage was and the seriousness of the covenant and all the things that are going into that relationship, if we would dwell on the front end, we would have to dwell with or deal with the back end of it less frequently than we do. I think that's the key. I'm not saying you don't have to deal with it. You do. God has teachings and very specific teachings about that. But I think what we need to do is we need to impress on young people when they're getting married what marriage is to begin with and the covenant nature of that and that God doesn't really like this whole idea at all in regards to the dissolution of marriage. And we'll talk about that in a moment. But helping people understand this is something that you've got to stick to for the rest of your life. That's the kind of commitment it is. How much commitment does it take? I always ask people, how much commitment does it take to come to God? Do you grow in your commitment to God after you become a Christian or not? I think that's going to depend on how you're viewing that question. Because let me ask it this way. Does God say, you know what, I need you to come to me, but it's okay if you come to me partially committed. We'll work on the rest of that commitment later. Or does God say, I'm asking you to give up everything to come to me? I need you to be absolutely, totally committed day one when you come to me. I think that's what he's asking for, biblically. I think God says, I need your commitment. Now, here's the thing. I don't understand what all that commitment involves. So I grow in my commitment because I grow in my understanding of that commitment and what it means. But my commitment needs to be absolute from day one. I need to be saying, God is my God, and I give up all else. That's the nature of repentance. I turn away from me toward God and say, I will do what God asked me to do. I learn all about that as I continue to grow in my relationship. But the commitment is there to start with. I think it's the same in marriage. I understand now, after 34 years, what that commitment in marriage means a whole lot differently than I did then. And I'm able to make application of things that I couldn't make application of then. But the day I married, committed 100% to everything that I said. I wasn't coming half promising anything. It's serious. He wants total commitment from day one to him. He wants total commitment from day one within our marriage. We learn the process as we go along. But your heart has to be given over totally to begin with. And that's what he's telling us. If we could convince couples that God is asking you right now to go in this understanding the serious nature of it. And then finally, that marriage and covenants, neither one, come with escape mechanisms. I'm not saying God doesn't permit. He does. He says in the case of infidelity in a marriage that he does permit the dissolution of that marriage and allow another marriage. But that's not where you should start that discussion. I understand that's a part of it. But I always say, if you want to start the discussion on divorce and the whole concept of divorce and dissolution of marriage, let's start with what God feels about it. Then talk about what he allows. Because in Malachi, he tells you what he feels about it. God hates divorce, period. He hates divorce. Why? Because it is the breaking of that vow. He hates that. It reflects badly on the people involved. It reflects badly on him. He hates the concept. Even though he allows an exclusion, God is saying marriage was never intended for the people to get out of. That was never its intent. Its intent was to come together once and to stay together as long as you both shall live. Those five words were in my ceremony. As long as you both shall live. For better or for worse. That's what he's asking of us. He didn't intend it to be an escapable arrangement, but our society looks for the escape. And that's the nature of contract versus covenant. You get a Cracker Jack lawyer, it doesn't matter almost what kind of contract he can find some loopholes in contracts. We understand that. We watch that regularly in our court system. He says you can't approach marriage that way. You can't be looking for loopholes. We have to understand God didn't intend. Jesus lived in a time when they were very much like we. They were just divorcing for any cause. And Jesus said, go back to the beginning, he said in Matthew 19. What did God intend of marriage in the beginning? It isn't about me being happy and me being content and me being satisfied. Here's the real question. The real question is, am I going to keep my promise or not keep my promise? That's what God wants to know. It's a vow. Am I telling the truth when I say those things, or do I make myself a liar? I know that sounds hard and that sounds cruel, but God is saying that's the nature of covenant. It is more serious than we treat it in this life. I would ask you this, because as I think about marriage and its tie to my relationship with God, and I think in terms of what that means, God made that covenant with Abram in Genesis 15. Abram didn't pass between those animals. God did. That was God's covenant. Think Abram ever gave God cause to leave him? You ever given God cause to leave you? See, it's not an issue of whether I've given him cause. It's an issue of whether he's taken it. God says, I made promises to Abram. And Israel turned their back on him over and over again. But it didn't make any difference because God had made a promise, and if God makes a promise, he's faithful to the promise. We know that. That's the nature of my relationship with him as well. There is nothing that he has ever promised me that he will not be absolutely, totally faithful to. He wants me to understand that. He will always be faithful. He says, and so if I've made covenants, I've made vows, that's the nature of my marriage, he says, I want you to approach it the way I approach it. I want you to be faithful. Why? Because it is what you've promised. That's what he said in Deuteronomy chapter 23. I can tell you, I'm grateful. Grateful that God is faithful. Grateful that God is the God of second and more chances. Because there have been numerous times in my life where God would have been justified saying, you've lost all your chances. You just can't come home. But what he has said instead every time is, if you'll turn around and you'll come back, I'll take you back. Why? Because he promised that he would do that. He told us. In 1 John, John says, if we'll confess our sins, he is faithful. That's the key. He's faithful. He told you if you confess, he'll take you back. That's the nature of life, and I'm so thankful that God has made promises that I know he'll ever be faithful to. All of us were created, even as Rick prayed earlier, I wasn't created in imperfection. I was formed by God in the magnificent beauty in which he formed all of us, but I was deformed by sin. Now, reformed by God, and he offers every one of us that chance.